Welcome to the Lesbian Book Club with Claire Lydon. Please enjoy the podcast from My Lesbian Radio.
Hello and welcome to episode 24 of the Lesbian Book Club with me, your host, Claire Lydon. This month we have a fabulous interview with longtime author Lynn Ames, and you'll hear that in full in a few moments. And it's, I don't know why I suddenly went Australian then. And it's great to have Lynn on actually, because I emailed her quite a while back asking her if she'd be interested in coming on the podcast. But somehow the email didn't get through to her. It fell down the back of her virtual sofa. But then she found it and contacted me again months later and asked if I was still interested, which of course I was. And so it's brilliant to have Lynn on, and she's a terrific interviewee, and you can hear that in a few minutes. But hurrah, episode 24. The podcast is now in its early 20s, nearly mid-20s. Clearly, everything seems possible and the world is at our feet, or else we're going to have a quarter-life crisis any minute now. I'll let you know which way it's going to go. But I'm certainly thrilled to still be doing the podcast every month. 24, that's 2 years, right? I've just realised. 2 years it's been going. Happy birthday to us. I'm loving doing it every month, and I hope you're enjoying the podcast too. I've got a stack of authors lined up to appear up and into the new year, 2017, which is only a couple of months away now, isn't it? I hope you've all started Christmas shopping, because the countdown is on. 2017, where has the year gone? But, well, I kind of do know where the year has gone, because I've worked really hard. I've got a lot done this year, so I'm very pleased with myself. Give myself a pat on the back. But anyway, before we get to the main interview, we're going to have a look at what's hot in the UK and the US lesbian fiction charts, and then give you a roundup of what I've been up to in the last month or so. First up, the Amazon charts. And this month, at number one in the US, as I record this, is Diane Marina with her novel, How Still My Love, which sounds gorgeously poetic. I'm sure you'll agree. Now, a BookBub sale shot this book to the top of the charts. You know the drill, 99p or 99 cents. BookBub sends the email to their readership, and their readership buys it. And I am part of BookBub's readership, and I do buy these offers, so it works. I love BookBub as a reader and a writer, because I've also had some books on a BookBub offer, so it works brilliantly for me in both capacities. This book, Diana Marina's book, concerns the travails of happily single Beth and sexy, vivacious Tony. And it's always a sexy, vivacious Tony. I don't know why I went in there. Clearly an accent day for me today. Beth and Tony get it on, but then things go awry and chaos breaks loose, apparently. Will they have their happy ending? Da da da! I'm not sure, but the book's 99 cents, so it'll probably be off sale by the time you hear this. But it was, and you may have got it. Also doing well in the US is Giselle Fox with her new book, Rare and Beautiful Things. Now, Giselle is cranking out the books at a fair old pace, and this one features Amber Grail, a 32-year-old virgin, and you don't get many of them to the pound. But Amber meets Nikki Sharp, an athletic shipwreck diver. So Giselle Fox scores extra points with me for having such an unusual occupation in a lesbian book, shipwreck diver. Well done, Giselle. Ka-ching for you. The pair, Amber and Nikki, find a journal in a sunken ship and uncover a story there, as well as taking a more personal journey of their own, of course. Will Amber still be as virginal by the end? You'll have to read the book and find out. And number one in the UK and top five in the US is J.A. Armstrong with book seven in her off-screen series, Waiting in the Wings. We're back with Addison and Emma from this long-running series, their kids and their daily issues. And fans are thrilled. After a bit of a wait for this one, it shot right up the charts. So well done to J.A. Armstrong, a.k.a. Nancy Ann Healy. And Nancy was my guest on episode 21 of the podcast. So if you want to hear more about J.A. or Nancy, who are the same person, spooky, have a listen to that. This month, too, it's also a welcome return to the charts for UK author Jade Winters with her new book, Flirting with Danger. Now, Jade has had a little break of a few months because she was as well cranking out the books at a feral pace. And this new one centres around career journalist Astrid Williams, who's assigned to the case of a missing teen, where she meets the enigmatic Carrie, who's a family friend of the missing teen. Does Carrie hold the key to crack the case, or does she just hold the key to Astrid's heart? That bit's not on the blurb, everyone. I just added it. See, I ad-libbed. But great to see Jay back in the charts, and this one looks like another winner to me. Finally, also back in the charts is huge reader favourite Jay with her new medical drama, Heart Trouble. This one, the character with the, well, actually, no, not the character with the said heart trouble, but maybe in a different way, right, is Dr. Hope Finley, who could do with working on her bedside manner as she keeps people at arm's length. The opposite is waitress Layla Samady, who loves sticking her beak into other people's lives, frankly. And when Layla has a spot of heart trouble, Hope saves her life, and then their story begins. So, I like that. It's a case of opposites attract and a bit of will they, won't they? You'll have to read the book to find out. Will they, won't they? So some really cracking books in the top fives in both UK and US, I'm sure you'll agree. What else has been happening in the world since we last met? Well, since we last spoke, I released All I Want for Autumn, which is book five in my All I Want series. This one is a bit more reflective for Tori and Holly. They're getting over stuff and they're moving on with their lives. And as their careers pull them in separate directions, will they stay the course of true love? It's the penultimate book in the series, and it will culminate in the early part of 2017, I think, with All I Want Forever, which is the final book. As I've said before, I did get quite emotional writing book five, All I Want for Autumn. It's got a super romantic ending, slushy. And I did shed a tear. I got a bit emotional writing it. And I have started writing the final book, All I Want Forever. I'm about 10,000 words in. So as I said, probably early part of 2017, might slip in under this year, but I'm no promises because I'm kind of, I've written a lot this year, so I'm not giving a hard deadline on that. I'm just ploughing on and seeing where I go with it. I'm also plotting the third book in my London series, as yet untitled. One of my goals this year was to get better at titles, and I have in a way, because All I Want, but that was kind of easier because it kind of, you know, it could only be certain things, whereas coming up with another title with London in. I haven't done either of the first two. Yeah, you know, I've had quite a lot of help with the first two, so I'm trying to do the title. But anyway, I'm plotting London 3. I'm going to be writing that to this year as well, and that'll be out beginning of 2017. Q1 for both of them, I think. In September, I also took a couple of weeks off writing because I've written quite a lot in 2016, so I just had a couple of weeks doing things, really dull things like my accounts. And here's a top tip: don't leave them for over a year, so you have to do the whole lot in one go. I did that, and then I was looking at my accounts for last April going, what the hell was that spent on? No idea, some of them. So trying to figure that out was fun. I'm also choosing a new fabric for my office blinds that my sister is making. Yes, I'm living the rock and roll dream. But, you know, it's good to get all these little things out the way. And in personal news, my wife and I did London Cocktail Week at the start of October, which was brilliant. Discount cocktails in swanky bars all around London. What's not to love? My kind of night, really. What I've realised is I love bourbon. And give me an old-fashioned of any sort and I'm a happy, happy camper. I'm I also had, it's my birthday in September, and I also had a super, like, the most sunny and melty birthday I think I've had in living memory. I don't remember it ever being as hot. It was 85 degrees in London on my birthday in mid-September, which is incredible. Normally quite nice in September, but not that nice. But now it's definitely autumn. There's loads of leaves on the ground in London town, and I've got the heat on, so autumn's here. Anyway, enough about me. Next up, we have my interview with the fantastic Lynn Ames. Enjoy. So joining me today is American author Lynn Ames. Lynn is a best-selling, award-winning writer of lesbian fiction, best known for her books All That Lie Within, her historical novel Bright Lights of Summer, as well as her series involving her much-loved characters Kate and Jay, the most recent of those being Final Cut. Lynn lives in Phoenix, Arizona, and almost as well-known as Lynn in the lesbian community are her dogs, Parker and Dixie. So welcome, Lynn.
Thank you, Claire. It's a pleasure to be here. And actually, I have to correct you a little bit. Parker and Dixie are much better known than I am. They're prettier, too.
Okay, yeah, I stand corrected. they look gorgeous. I've seen them online. Have they ever accompanied you to any of the lesbian conventions you've been to?
You know what? These two particular dogs haven't, but my light and my joy, Alex, who was also a golden retriever, he went to me on my very first book signing in Northampton, Massachusetts, and the audience was far more interested in him.
Right.
He was actually the model for Fred in the Kate and Jay series, so everybody wanted his autograph. I don't think anybody really cared much for mine. But I was okay with that.
Yeah.
Love my dog and I'm in heaven.
Yeah. Dogs always, you know, put you in your place, don't they?
Back at the bus for me.
Yeah. So paint a picture of where you're speaking to us from today for listeners.
Sure. I live in the desert. It has its own beauty. I'm surrounded by, sunshine and cactus and all kinds of wildlife. And it's about, let's see, right now it's roughly 73 degrees. And it is a gorgeous sunny day, not a cloud in the sky. A perfect place to sit outdoors and reflect, or to exercise, or to, I don't know, write.
Yeah, sounds good. And is it, I guess you're living in the desert, so it's pretty hot all year round, is it?
It is actually a misnomer. It's not hot all year round. The summers are rather brutal. I don't know what the conversion would be to Celsius, but it's 120 degrees Fahrenheit. And sometimes in the summer. So yes, that is incredibly hot. Some people like to tell you that's a dry heat. I like to say, so is sticking your head in the oven. You don't really want to do it. But the rest of the year, like starting around now, between now and say the end of May, is absolutely delightful.
Mm-hmm.
The temperatures are moderate. It's in the 60s, 70s, 80s, which is all not bad when you have a dry heat. And in the winter, actually, the desert floor can get quite chilly in the winter. We get down to freezing.
Oh, okay.
During the night. And then it warms right up during the day, and it's beautiful and it's perfect, and you can eat outdoors and enjoy yourself, and just the perfect climate at that time of the year. So really, if you can get through the 4 months of summer here, you're pretty much golden.
Yeah, okay. Lots of air conditioning.
Lots of air conditioning, yeah. House is air conditioned, car is air conditioned.
Yeah.
Places you go are air conditioned. There you go. You don't have to shovel heat, which is an awesome thing.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell me a bit about your writing journey, Lynn, and how you got started.
Well, I actually wrote my first book when I was 8 years old, and while it was rather rudimentary, I found it recently, and I was, sort of afraid to read it, but I thought, you know what, in for a penny, in for a pound, I might as well give it a shot. So I sat down and I read it, and the story was simplistic, but the interesting thing about it was that the grammar was quite good. I was very proud of myself.
Okay.
But I began publishing, writing for publication, around the turn of the century, 2000, 2001, 2002, somewhere in there. I was writing a mainstream, regular thriller, and some friends of mine read it and insisted that the book was missing something. And I said, well, what is it missing? And, well, it's missing lesbians is what it's missing.
Of course it is.
Oh, well, there you go. How about that? I said, there's only one of them in the book. Well, find another. Okay. So After 6 months of pestering me and cajoling me, I finally acquiesced and wrote what became The Price of Fame, my first published novel.
Mm-hmm.
It was published in 2004 originally. And as they say, the rest is history. I now have 13 books in print, and I'm in the middle of writing a romantic comedy called Great Bones, which I hope will be a lot of fun for the audience. It's certainly a lot of fun for me. Every story that you've ever heard about a bad date is going into this book.
Okay, that sounds good. Because, you know, the material is can be very rich with those kind of stories, right?
Well, sure it is from my life, so there you go.
Yeah.
I can build it by myself.
And that first book that you had published, was that with a publisher, or was that self-published?
Yeah, no, it was with a publisher originally. It was with Intaglio Publications. I originally published with Intaglio Publications my first, five books were with Intaglio.
Mm-hmm.
Where I went out on my own in 2009, 2010. I created Phoenix Rising Press, my own small press. And I didn't want to take a chance on other authors at that point. More accurately, I didn't want them taking a chance on me. I really wanted to test the process and make sure that I had done my homework and that I had a model that would work, that would be successful. And I wasn't going to risk anybody else's reputation with that. So I tested it on myself, on my own titles. And, fortunately for me, within the first 6 months, I was profitable. And it's worked out very well ever since. And as it turned out, you know, my timing was rather fortuitous. It just preceded the real boom in ebooks. And so my books are available in print and in ebook. And now 5 of them are available as audiobooks as well. And more will become available in that format. So
okay.
So I caught the wave at the right moment.
Yeah, you definitely did. Yeah, you're a very early adopter there, which is cool. And
yeah,
I assume that you're a full time writer now.
Yes, I am a full time writer right now. Always be, and I'm so fortunate and so blessed to be able to do that. To do what I love to do and to have people want to buy my products is just, I mean, that's remarkable. It's just remarkable.
Yep, no, I'm with you all the way on that one. So I read your latest book, Final Cut, which I really enjoyed before we spoke today, and it's a very intriguing novel based around sort of government stifling and freedom of speech, and deals with corruption, greed, romance, danger. It's sort of romantic intrigue, I guess, right?
Exactly.
And you used to work as a press secretary, which as did one of your leads. So are you drawing a lot of your experience going with this novel?
I know a lot of things, Claire. I know a lot of things. A lot of things I can't talk about. No, but
yeah.
Yes, I have a background in broadcast media and in politics and government in the U.S. and in public relations. And I have drawn on every bit of that in any number of my titles. You know, I've had the great good fortune to be in a lot of places where history is made and to be part of that. And so I have taken, you know, snippets from all of my experience and all that I have learned, and I have incorporated that into my fiction for sure. You know, for me, I'm a great believer that fiction can be not only entertaining but educational as well. And if I can shed some light, shine some light on some things that really need light shown on them, then I am very grateful to be able to do that and to be in a position to do that. So yes, I will tell you that many of my novels draw on some personal experience. I believe that all great fiction begins with a kernel of truth, or maybe more than a kernel of truth. You'll just never know, will you?
Mm-hmm.
But yes, so I have drawn on a lot of my own experience and on, you know, experiences of people that I know, and I'm a great one for research as well. So I've done copious amounts of research on every book I've written, and with a reporter's background, I kind of enjoy doing that. I kind of enjoy interviewing people and finding things out and, you know, delving into the details. So yes, there's a lot of personal experience in there, and a lot of the lessons that I teach are based on personal experience, sure.
Okay, and what do you think that you might sort of get some story ideas from what's going on in U.S. politics right now?
I get a great comedy routine out of what's going on.
Yeah.
Right. You know, it's funny, Claire. I'm interested to hear an overseas perspective, which clearly you would have. You know, to me, all of my friends, you know, my background, and they're all calling me and coming to me and asking me out to lunch, and they're all extremely worried about what's going to happen here. And I keep very calm, and I keep saying to them, stop worrying, stop worrying, stop worrying. And they can't believe that I am as calm as I am. And I keep telling them, I know things. You know, I understand the underpinnings of these things. I understand the way these things work. I've been in rooms where these things have happened. I've done the polling. I've done all of those kinds of things. I've had every job you can imagine in the background of a political campaign. So I understand what's not being said. I understand what's behind what is being said. Honestly, I am very confident right now that the outcome that we are going to get is the outcome that is for everyone's highest good. And I think there's only one outcome that, you know, meets those criteria. I don't even think I need to say it, do I?
No, you don't. But,
really?
I know. I am comforted to hear that, actually, because my dad says the same thing. He's like, you know, my parents used to live in Canada, and he said, you know, I've seen this happen before in America when we lived in Canada, and you know, he always says, don't worry about it, it won't happen. But you know, I think because Brexit happened here, and no one thought that would happen, and we were all shocked by that everybody here is a bit nervous. So, but I'll take your word that it'll be okay.
Reasonably so, and you know, I mean, one of the interesting things about it is this is a fascinating time in history. This is just a fascinating time in history.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I think what's truly happening, you know, beyond the election itself, what's truly happening here is sometimes you truly have to tear things down and break them apart in order to fix them and build them better. And I really think that that is what we are doing here with the American political system and the governmental system. I think we are breaking it down, and we're going to make it better.
Okay.
This is a way. It's a wake-up call.
Sounds good. Getting back to your books, so as we said, Final Cut is book 4 in the Kate and Jay series, and I only just realised today that it's been quite a while since you wrote book 3. 10 years. Was this book 4, was that like a surprise? If this is book 4, how long were the first 3 over, and was it always planned to be a series from the beginning?
Good questions, Claire. Those are all good questions. Here is the truth about the Kate and Jay series. When I sat down to write The Price of Fame, the very first book in the series, I didn't know it was going to be a series. I actually thought it was going to be that The Price of Fame was like a 20-page introduction to the actual book.
Mm-hmm.
And I only intended there to be originally one book. It was one story to me. But as, you know, sometimes happen, more things started to come to me, and the more things that came to me, the more intricate the plot became, and the 20-page introduction that was supposed to be to the main story, which was going to be what became The Cost of Commitment and The Value of Valor, the next two books in the series, actually became its own book. And I realized that there was so much more to the story that I needed to tell.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote The Price of Fame, and then I wrote... shortly thereafter, I wrote The Cost of Commitment, and The Value of Valor followed the year after that. And honestly, I thought it was a trilogy. I thought I was done. But, you know, I'm so blessed to know that Kate and Jay are so popular. They were my most popular characters, my most beloved characters. People would write to me and simply ask what Kate and Jay were doing.
Right.
You know, they were actually alive, which was both alarming and fascinating and, you know, flattering at the same time. So... a little bit of everything there. I was a little worried for a while. but, you know, if I had wanted to make a lot of money, I just would have written a fourth book right then. But I didn't, because I couldn't, you know, I really wanted to do it in integrity. I wanted to write what was in my heart, and I wanted to be, I wanted to do the characters justice. And while I could always see the character arc moving forward for Jay, I couldn't quite figure out what Kate was going to do going forward. And so I resisted everyone's entreaties to write a fourth book in the series to keep the series going until finally last year it struck me what it was Kate would be doing present day. And that's when I knew that I was ready to write the fourth book in the series. And, you know, when I realized that there were synergies between those characters and the characters from All That Lies Within, Dara and Rebecca, I mean, that just made it so much richer for me and so much more fun to write. And you know, the only characters that have ever eclipsed Kate and Jay in popularity are Dara and Rebecca. So to put all four of them in one novel was just so much fun for me to do. It was so much fun for me to do. And it was difficult because when you, as you can imagine, pick up a series 10 years later and haven't really written those characters at any length in 10 years,
yeah,
you know, that was a very very intricate series, and so there was a lot of history and a lot of things that had happened that I needed to be consistent in present day, and I needed to make sure that everything just worked out right, and that was a challenge. It was certainly a challenge, and as you know, the plot for Final Cut was no easy plot.
Nope, very involved.
it was kind of intricate, and there were a lot of moving parts to it.
Yeah.
But I really enjoyed the challenge of it. I enjoyed bringing back everyone's most beloved characters, whether they were Darren, Rebecca, or Kate and Jay, and putting them all in one place. That was just a kick for me, and I really enjoyed it. And I had something I felt was very important to say about government secrecy and, about being your best, most authentic self and sticking to your truth.
Mm-hmm.
And I really wanted to say it, and to be able to use those beloved characters to do it was just icing on the cake for me.
And how have fans reacted? Because obviously, I guess you've managed to please the Kate and Jay fans, and also the All That Lies Within fans.
Yeah, go me.
Yeah, well done. That's a high five.
Right, there you go. Thank you for the high five. Final Cut has been very, very well received, and I'm so grateful for all that. And sales have been very, very good, and all of the comments have been very complimentary, and I'm just so grateful that I was able to do the characters justice and that everyone seems to be satisfied with what I did. Now, of course, they want me to write another one, don't you know?
Of course.
Of course, why not? And I may yet. I have certainly left the door open to do that. And as I learned after writing the first three, never say never.
Yep, no, absolutely.
Never say never here.
Yep.
So I won't say that that's never going to happen. I don't know. I tend to write what's in my heart when it's in my heart. And right now, Great Bones, this romantic comedy that I'm working on, that's what's in my heart. And who knows what it'll be next? You never know. I mean, I've written historical fiction, as you know, and I've written contemporary romance, and I've written action-adventure romance. I've written thrillers and some mystery, and, it is what it is. And I'm very grateful that I have very loyal readers who tend to follow whatever it is I decide to do.
Okay, yeah, no, that's really cool. And talking of your best historical fiction, which Bright Lights of Summer won a Goldie for best historical fiction, right? And you've also won a sackful of awards, Goldies, an Anne Bannon Award, a Rainbow Award, to name a few. So what are the ingredients that you think ensures your books resonate so much and with readers and win these awards?
You know what, Clara? I wish I knew. If I knew, I could win it every time, wouldn't I?
Yeah.
Lovely. But you know what? Here's the thing. I am so appreciative and so grateful for the awards because it's, it is an honor, obviously. It's an honor and it's a great privilege. And it is an indication of the quality of the fiction. And I greatly appreciate that folks think that my work is that high quality. I certainly try to make every book I write the very best book I've ever written. And honestly, that's the ingredient. I don't write for the awards. I don't write thinking, oh, this one's going to win a Goldie, or this one's going to win a Lammy, or this one's going to win the Anne Bannon Award. I write because it's the story I feel compelled to tell, and I am always, always compelled to tell it in the very best way I can, and to be the very best writer I can. When I stop learning, when I stop growing, when I stop becoming a better writer, I should stop, period. I shouldn't write anymore. You should always be striving to get better, always striving to be the very best I can be. And if that wins me awards along the way, then I am incredibly grateful for that.
Yeah.
So grateful for the acknowledgement of what I've done.
Yeah. Do you have a little shelf that you keep them all on?
They're on my desk.
Okay, cool.
There's a bunch of them. They're on the left side of my desk where I can see them as I'm, sort of procrastinating while I'm writing. When I'm looking out the window and thinking about what's on my grocery list, I look at those and I say, yeah, you know what? Get to work.
Yeah, you're a writer. You should do some writing.
Yeah, I should actually write.
Yeah. And Bright Lights of Summer focuses on two women, female softball players during World War II. What inspired that one?
Two words, one name, Dot Wilkinson. Dot Wilkinson, who is about to be 95, she'll be 95 years old on Sunday, and we'll celebrate our birthdays together, as we always do every year. Dot Wilkinson is the most remarkable woman I know. She is widely believed to be the best female catcher who ever played the game of softball. She's a 19-time All-American and a 3-time world champion, and has the biggest heart of anybody I know. But all anybody knew about the period around World War II was A League of Their Own, the wonderful Penny Marshall movie from 1992.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That didn't tell the real story of softball in that era. These were groundbreaking women who made it possible for all of us today to do many of the things that we do. And, you know, Dot was one of those players. And, you know, she's a very dear friend of mine. She's really family to me. And, you know, the more I spent time with her and the more I talked to her, the more I realized how important it was to preserve that history of time, that history of what really happened in sports at that time and in the game of softball at that time. And A League of Their Own was actually the smallest part of what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to tell the truth. I wanted to tell the story. And for a long time, Dot resisted my telling it. She wanted me to wait until she was dead. And as I said, she's almost 95, and we go out to lunch every weekend, and she's perfectly sharp. And I told her I didn't have until she was 150. Couldn't wait that long. You know, can I please, please tell your story?
That's really interesting. How did you two meet?
I was interviewing her for a television show I had. So I met her a bunch of years ago. I was interviewing her and her pitcher, Billy Harris, who was the first African-American of either gender inducted into a softball Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
A very interesting woman in her own right. And so I met Dot through Billy. And, you know, I interviewed them. And the day I interviewed them, I handed Dot a copy of my other award-winning historical fiction book, Eyes on the Stars, which is about the World War II women Air Force service pilots.
Right, okay, yep.
And she fell in love with the book. She called me a few days later. She'd read it in 2 days. She read it in 2 days' time. And I thought, you know, I spent a long time writing that book. I really would have appreciated it if you took a little more time. Or as I said to her, did you read every word or every third word? She swore to me that she read every single word, and I believe her. But she was so in love with that book, and she was convinced that I was just fictionalizing someone's true story. Which, you know, it took me a long time to convince her that those characters weren't real people. I made them up. Because she had friends who had done what I was describing.
Yeah, okay.
The Wasp. And that's how, I mean, to her it was very real. And, I mean, to me, that was the greatest compliment anybody could have paid me, that I got it so right that someone of that era thought that it was real. Okay, I'll take that.
Yeah.
But we became fast friends, and then she wanted to read everything I had, so I gave her every book that was in print at the time of mine. And we started, you know, this incredible friendship. We started talking to each other every day and going out to lunch once a week. And, you know, it just progressed from there. And I, you know, when I finally convinced her, thank goodness, to write Bright Lights of Summer, you know, I created two fictional characters and she allowed me to put them in her very real world. And she was very afraid that everyone would think that my character, Diz, was her. And I promised her that that would never happen. And she said, well, how do you know that? You can't know that. And I said, well, actually, I really can, because I'm going to put you in the book as you, you know. So I'm pretty sure you can't be two people at once. Not even you could be two people at one time.
Yeah, right.
You know, so I was able to really write the story of her life, the story of her team.
How cool.
In a fictional way. And then I made a documentary out of Dot's life, which was called Extra Innings. And, you know, again, this is about, when I write historical fiction, Claire, it's really about preserving history.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, this generation, this next generation, they don't necessarily know what it was like to be gay in the 1940s, 1930s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they need to know. They really need to know. How can you know where you're going unless you know where you've been?
Mm-hmm. No, yeah, absolutely. No, it sounds very interesting, and I'm going to go and buy it.
Yay!
I haven't read it, but you've convinced me, so I will buy it after this interview. No, and it's very cool that it's based on such someone that you know so personally. So I'm sure that gave it an extra nuance.
Oh, it really did.
Yeah.
And she loved the book, by the way. She wouldn't read it while I was writing it. I wanted her to read as I was writing in case I got something, you know, too close to something that was, you know, alarming to her, but she wouldn't do it. She said, you know, I'm going to read it when everybody else does. And I tried to explain to her. I said, Dot, you realize that I can't change it once it's out there. She said, I know. I trust you.
Mm-hmm.
I said, oh, my God, really? Wow. But I handed her the very first copy of the book, and she read it in a day and called me the very next morning and just was in love with the book, and I was so relieved.
Yeah.
Oh my, I thought thought she was going to, you know, if not, she can still swing a baseball bat. I'm just saying, my head was in danger.
Yeah, but no, awesome that she was pleased with that. That's really cool. So you, as you said, you were a journalist and had a corporate career prior to becoming an author. So how did you cope with the change of lifestyle when it happened?
Well, let's say my income changed a lot, and not in the positive way. There, you know, I'm a great believer that you really have to do what you love and love what you do. And I just, you know, was at a point in my life where I had accomplished professionally a lot, and you know, I just didn't feel like I needed to do that anymore. I really wanted to get off, you know, off the ride, and to live my life more quietly and more in a way that was gentle and in a way that I really wanted to live it. Mm-hmm. And yes, that required a great lifestyle adjustment for me, you know, because it changed my circumstances quite a bit. But I also believe that if you are doing what you love to do, if you're doing what you are passionate about, and if you don't make it about the money, but rather about what you love to do, everything else will fall into place for you. Mm-hmm. And I've been very, very fortunate, you know, that it really has.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Totally agree with you on that one.
Doesn't mean there aren't moments when I've struggled mightily, many, by the way, but you know what? It's worth it to me. And, you know, I see a bright, bright present and a bright future. So I'm not worried about it. I know that I'm doing what I'm meant to do.
It's all part of the journey, as they say. So can you describe your writing process these days? Do you write better at a certain time of the day? Do you always write in the same place?
Interesting. You know what? I can write pretty much anywhere. And I do write pretty much anywhere. I mean, sometimes I'm sitting at my desk, like I am right now. Sometimes I'm sitting in a pub, as you would call it over there, mm-hmm. and a sports bar, as I would call it here. And I'm, you know, sitting at the bar drinking my Diet Coke and eating a grilled chicken salad and writing there. You know, sometimes I'm writing in airports and on airplanes, and I can write pretty much anywhere. In terms of time of day, I have found over time that there are certain times of day where I'm far better at it and where I'm far more productive. I've seen, you know, my rhythm is generally in the morning I will meditate and I will exercise and I will take care of the business side of the business, because let's face it, I run a publishing company, it's a business. Mm-hmm. And so I take care of the business aspects of everything in the morning, and then come around anytime from 11 to 1, I start getting the urge to be very creative and to sit down and write. And so I will write generally from that time until whenever I feel like I'm done, whenever I feel like I've said whatever it is I need to say. Sometimes it's, you know, in 4 hours at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and sometimes it's 1 o'clock in the morning. It just depends on what I'm writing. And honestly, I get a lot more creative the closer I get to deadline.
It's funny how that happens, isn't it?
It's odd. It's truly odd.
Yeah. That's interesting, actually, because I think perceived wisdom is that write in the morning and then do your business side in the afternoon. But I'm with you. I much prefer doing all the other stuff in the morning, so going for a walk.
I feel like you have to have a clear head, don't you? And to have a clear head, I have to get everything out of the way.
Yeah.
I have to put the decks for it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So you don't have set word counts every day, you just go with the flow.
I don't ever set a word count for myself. I have a, you know, in my mind, I have a target number of pages I'd like to get done. But honestly, my feeling is if I'm not inspired to write it at that moment, why would you be inspired to read it? Mm-hmm. So I write when I'm inspired to write, you know, and as I said, fortunately, I get more inspired the closer I get to deadline. But, you know, I tend to find that if I can truly spend 4 dedicated hours, I can get a lot more done than I could if I just made myself sit at the desk for 8 hours. I just frustrate the heck out of myself and aggravate myself if I do that. And I don't want to write when I'm aggravated. I do this because I love to do it. So why would I do it when I'm not loving it?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Do you set word counts for yourself? Do you?
I sort of arbitrary ones, yeah. But I tend to sort of have writing bursts. So, you know, I'll have a really, really productive month and then not as productive a month the next one. So,
get a lot done in that month.
Yeah. Yeah, February this year was my most productive month. So, and as someone's pointed out to me, it's the shortest month of the year. So I don't know what that says, but, you know, there you go. And do you have any mantras that you use when you're writing? Have you got anything sort of stuck on your wall to inspire you?
There's nothing stuck on my wall that inspires me. What inspires me is is, you know, I, in my head, I hear what people have said about my work and what inspires them about my work and what it means to them. And that means everything to me. And, you know, I remind myself of the first lessons I learned, the most important lessons I learned in fiction, which is, of course, show, don't tell. I sort of model my, I look at every scene that way, and I think, am I doing my best to, you know, bring the reader into the scene and make them part of this journey? Are they inside it or are they outside it? You know, that's really the question here. And is whatever I'm writing, is it moving the plot forward? Is it enlightening the reader about the character? If not, it doesn't belong in there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Good. Good points. And also, you, I saw on your Twitter feed you're going to Women's Week in Provincetown in October, right?
Next week.
Yes, very exciting. So I hear a lot about this from authors, but being over here, I've never been. So as someone who's never been, and can you tell us a bit about what happens there and what you're doing there?
Oh, what happens in Provincetown stays in Provincetown. yeah, I can tell you lots about it. Provincetown is like a second home to me, honestly. I've been going there for well more than 30 years now, maybe 35 years, I think. But okay. And Women's Week has been around for quite a long time, almost maybe 32 years now.
I'd like to get there one year.
Oh, you really should. You would so enjoy it. I mean, it's wall-to-wall women. In this lovely, quaint New England town, and we take over the town, essentially. You know, Provincetown has a reputation, a long reputation, as being a haven for gays and lesbians, and it truly is. Although, you know, the more we become mainstream, the more mainstream becomes part of our, you know, part of our space. Let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Do it nicely. They bus people in now. But, look at the lesbians. And over here, we have lesbians on this corner. And over here, there are lesbians on that corner, too. Yes, in any event, it's a wonderful week, and there are literally thousands of women in town. And there are events, there are comedy shows. You know, the best lesbian comics in the world come to Provincetown to perform during Women's Week. And there are beautiful, wonderful musicians, and you know, there are authors like me who come and we do readings and book signings, and there are events all over town. It's not just one place. There are events all the time, you know, every hour of the day, practically.
Okay.
Provincetown doesn't sleep during that week. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful time of year to be in New England. It's, you know, the weather is sometimes very variable. It can be 70 degrees and sunny, or 40 degrees and chilly and raining.
Mm-hmm.
You just never know. It's right on the water. It's on the ocean.
Okay.
It's on the Atlantic Ocean. So you just never know. But there's always something to do. And it's like a big family. There are so many people you run into that you've either, you know, met on Facebook, or you know personally, or have been following you for a while. You know, it's just a fabulous, high energy, wonderful vibration week. I highly recommend it. I
okay.
absolutely go.
Okay, well, that's a goal of mine, to get there 1 year, and I'm sure you might have inspired some listeners to go along 1 year as well.
Okay. So there are a bunch of Brits who come.
Mm-hmm.
There are a bunch who come. I love it. They enjoy it.
Yeah.
Enjoy listening to all of you. I just could listen to you read, and I'd be happy.
Yeah, well, you know, British people think the same about Americans, so, you know, that probably
really?
Everybody would be happy. Yeah, absolutely. And are you an avid reader of lesbian fiction?
You know what? Here is like one of life's great ironies. You become a writer because you love to read, right?
Mm-hmm.
I love to read. I love to read everything. And lesbian fiction honestly saved me many, many, many years ago when I didn't know what was going on. When I was first coming out back in my 20s, mm-hmm. many years ago, you know, there were no words for it. And there were no role models for it. And then I found lesbian fiction, and it changed my life. I saw myself reflected in the pages, and so I read everything I could get my hands on. Every book I could find, I read many times over, and I continue to do that. But one of the great ironies is, when you become a writer, you have less and less time to read, which is, you know, so unfortunate. So I try to take a few months off after I finish a book, and I just sit down and I read. And I just keep reading until I, you know, have read as many things as I can, you know, fit in that time frame.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because I really love it. I mean, I'm a fan. If I wasn't a fan, I wouldn't have, you know, been gravitated to write this fiction. I'd be writing something else.
Yeah. No. Yeah. I mean, I've spoken to some authors who are like, yeah, no, I can't read lesbian fiction now because I don't want to because I write it all day. So I find that interesting as well. Like they do still read, but they just don't read much lesfic. Whereas I'm a fan, so I read it as well.
Well, here's the thing. You know, I don't read it while I'm writing it.
Right.
That's why I took those months off to read it. I don't read it while I write it just because I don't want someone else's voice in my head.
Mm.
I'm true to my characters, to my voice, and that's what I've got. But boy, when I'm done writing, I can't wait to sit down and read.
Cool. And I was looking at you're quite a spiritual person. You're very zen about life and sort of going with the flow and following your path. Have you ever thought about writing a non-fiction book on sort of that sort of spiritual side of your life, or will you just stick to lesbian fiction?
No, I absolutely have, and many people have asked me to do it, and I actually will at some point sit down and do it. You know, it's quite a journey, and while I incorporate my spirituality into some of my writing, some of my lesbic writing, yes, I will at some point sit down and write a memoir, which many people have asked me to do, and I will, when I think I'm ready for that. Yeah, I'm not there yet, but I will at some point. And I hope that someone gets some wisdom out of it, or I hope it helps someone in some way. But yes, I absolutely will sit down and write a nonfiction book about my spirituality and about my spiritual path and, spirituality in general.
Okay. Something to look forward to. And what's next for you? Obviously not a memoir or a spirituality book yet, but what's next on your agenda?
You know what? I'm in the moment. So I'm writing Great Bones, and I'm very much, my head is fully involved in that. And, I am thinking very hard about the movies. I would like very much to see Bright Lights of Summer and Eyes on the Stars made into mainstream movies. And, so I've got screenplays running around in the back of my head at the same time. So that is in the mix for me, for sure. But in terms of what book I will write next, I don't know until I finish this one, and then it becomes more obvious to me.
Okay. You've got a few ideas percolating, have you?
Oh, yeah, I've got plenty of ideas.
Okay, that's good to know. And when do you think Great Bones is going to be out?
I had hoped that it would be out by the end of this year, by the end of this calendar year, meaning by December 31st. I don't know that I'm going to make that right now, but I'm going to be pretty close to it, I hope. So soon is the answer, very, very soon, I hope.
Okay.
This book is, like I said, it's so much fun to write, and unlike so many of my other books, it doesn't require a great deal of research. I lived a lot of this in terms of, it's sort of a very funny story about a woman who, a lesbian who writes romantic greeting cards for a living, and everybody, of course, is in love with her greeting cards, but the woman can't get a date in a Volkswagen full of lesbians. So it's sort of her fumbling story about trying to find herself and trying to find love. And it involves a really cool Jewish grandmother.
Oh, Jewish grandmas are always the best, so that's it.
Well, they're always funny, and I had one, I had a couple of those. So, so for me, it's just, all I have to do is close my eyes and channel my grandmother's, and it's right there. I've done the research, I've lived it.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's sort of an homage to them, and it's kind of funny.
Cool. So final question, if you could be the love child of any two writers, alive or dead, who would you choose and why?
Oh, my. Well, I've got two. I can give you the glib answer, the financial answer. Please give me J.K. Rowling and Charles Dickens. I'll take them together. That would be lovely. That would work out quite well for me, I think.
Yeah, I think you'd be all right there.
Yeah, I think I do quite well. But my favorite, you'll be interested to know that my favorite authors of all time are both British, Charles Dickens and Edith Wharton.
Okay.
If I could be their love child, I would be forever happy.
Yeah, I think
they weren't all that happy in life.
Yeah, I think you'd be minted and you'd be very talented too.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, we'll wrap this up now. So thank you ever so much, Lynn. It's been really, really fantastic talking to you.
Thank you for asking, Claire. I'm so grateful to you. Thank you for doing that.
It's been great. Thank you so much.
That's the end of this Lesbian Book Club. So this is me, your host, Claire Lydon, signing off. If you fancy dipping into any of my books, the All I Want series, the London series, Nothing to Lose, or The Long Weekend,
You can find out more at www.clairelydon.co.uk or just look me up on Amazon, Kobo, iTunes, Bella Books or any of the other digital outlets. I'm also on Twitter at Claire Lydon. I'm on Instagram at ClaireFic and I'm on Facebook Claire.Lydon. So come along, follow me there, join me. Let's all have a virtual hug. If you'd like to join my mailing list as well, you get 4 fantastic bonuses. Just head on over to my website, www.clairelydon.co.uk/newsletter-sign-up. Thanks to Denise for My Lesbian Radio for hosting and producing this podcast. It's much appreciated. And make sure you tune in to The Lesbian Lounge with Denise for all the latest LGBT news, views, interviews and gossip. And if you love this podcast, we'd love you to rate it on iTunes, Stitcher or any of the other anywhere else you might be listening to it. Reviews and ratings all help other people find it, so that'd be great. Join me next time for more hot book club action. See you then.